This is CISO to CISO, a live podcast focusing on information security, leadership, innovation, and more. Brought to you by Altitude Networks, data security for the cloud. Welcome, everyone. My name is Michael Coates. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Altitude Networks. This is another edition of CISO to CISO. I'm here as a former CISO. I'd spent my time at Twitter and also Mozilla. And we have Ben Hagen with us today. Ben has a full and lengthy background of security leadership. I'll touch on a few things, and Ben, then please introduce yourself. Running security elements at Cruise, has been at Facebook, at Salesforce, was at Netflix for many years, and then even more experience throughout the Midwest before that in a variety of security roles. So this is going to be super interesting. I'm really excited. Ben, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Of course, my pleasure.
So as we talk about the wonderful world of security, one of the things I think is fascinating is that it's just such a challenging role, such a challenging world, and it's very different in every situation. What was your security journey? How did you end up where you are today, you know, leading security at these amazing tech companies? How'd you get there?
Yeah, it's been a long road. Counting way back, I think I graduated college from a master's program in 2005 and have been working in the field of security ever since then. But I would say my interest goes way back before that as well, where, I think my family was very fortunate to, I think, get our first kind of desktop computer in the mid-80s. And, you know, back in the day, you couldn't use a computer without understanding computers in some way, shape, or form, even as like a young kid wanting to play video games, having to deal with like memory optimizers and config files and like rebooting to like clean environments to just be able to play the game that you want to play, I think taught me a lot about computers and kind of, I think, seeded that interest in how computers work and where they go from there. Moving through, moving into adulthood, I became more interested in some pretty kind of esoteric computer areas, like in the late 80s and early 90s, the demo scene was a big thing where people were basically writing assembly code to try and make computers do amazing things, like lots of graphics and audio and that kind of stuff. And that was wizardry that I wanted to understand and started playing around with. I had an older brother who actually went to school for computer science, and his experience that he passed on to me kind of, I'd say, soured me on the aspect of going through undergraduate with a computer-related field. It just didn't seem like the education that I wanted to get at the time. So I actually went through an undergrad program in political science and Mandarin Chinese, which was a really interesting opportunity to get away from technology and focus on other things that I'm passionate about. But when it came time to find a job after graduation, I immediately kind of picked up an opportunity to continue my education through graduate school into a field at Iowa State University, a degree called Information Assurance, which is basically computer security in other words. That led me into where we first met, working at Motorola right after graduation at the headquarters in Schaumburg, Illinois, starting in the Security Operations Center for Motorola, which I always describe to people as very War Games-like. We worked in a big theater atmosphere with like big screens with maps on them, big red circles on things to kind of note where problem spots are, that kind of thing. And eventually progressed into security consulting, both at Motorola and then at a company called NeoHapsis, which has since been acquired by Cisco, I believe. Was doing kind of the typical security consultant work of penetration tests, web application assessments, security reviews, those kind of things, when I had a really interesting opportunity to branch out of that world and join the Obama re-election campaign in 2012. I always say that I was the kind of the head of security there. In fact, I was the only security full-time hire there. So I was the head and the full team of security. And it was a really interesting experience for me. Really interesting environment that we can dig into later if people are interested, but really gave me an opportunity to kind of branch out of what security looks like at a functioning organization and how you can build it into that organization. After that opportunity, I kind of opened my world to a bunch of other work, made the move out to the West Coast to work at Netflix. During the campaign, I got experience working within AWS for the first time, and really wanted to focus on that with my next career step, and had the great opportunity to go to Netflix, which was, I think, one of the pioneers in terms of understanding public cloud security and what it means to have like a massive deployment in a public cloud architecture. Spent about 4 years there before taking an opportunity at Salesforce to lead their infrastructure assurance team. And then made my way through a bunch of other companies as well. From Salesforce, I went to Facebook and worked on as head of their corporate security and offensive security teams for a while, until it's brought me to where I currently am at Cruise, where we are working on kind of perfecting autonomous vehicle technology and trying to use it to the benefit of communities around the world.
Super awesome. It's so interesting that you mentioned tinkering with computers in order to play games as an entry point. That's I say the exact same thing. That was my motivation as well. And perhaps that was the indicator of an era where the computers did just enough if you made them get there and forced us to learn how to do it for the sole purpose of playing video games. So we can credit everything back to video games.
Yeah, I think it really teaches you some of the fundamentals that I think are useful in security, right? Like understanding some of those basics of like how do operating systems work at like a very functional level, what you can do to work in that environment. And of course, I think all kids get into, you know, pirating games and that kind of thing at some point, and like how do you remove copy protection and what does debugging look like? And eventually you go down a rabbit hole that is a pretty direct shot at security, I think.
Yeah, I recall finding that in middle school when the network started to exist at a school and then they put controls in place. You're like, well, wait, why can't I do this anymore? And then again, the rat hole, just like you said.
Yep. Absolutely.
So you've been both at Wargame Central at Motorola, and then on the other end, you're building self-driving cars and securing them. So you've lived the sci-fi world that we thought would exist one day. And in the middle, helped lead security for a campaign. That's got to be like totally different worlds, the campaign world and high-tech world. You know, what do the differences look like? How do you be successful at those? Did you find them to be different styles, techniques, challenges?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a lot of, you know, important differences, I think, but there's actually a lot of alignment too now, where you know, most, especially campaigns at a large scale, which would be most of the presidential campaigns, they operate like a fast-moving startup does in many, many ways. The big difference being that technology is not the product there. It's a supporting function to kind of further the mission of a campaign, which is, you know, pretty directly to get somebody elected and to get them to win an election. So I think you need to build a strong communication skills to help people understand, you know, what's the payoff for the investment in something like security or technology that will actually help this mission be driven forward. And that actually, I think, prepared me to get into kind of the technology companies of Silicon Valley in a surprisingly good way, where like the fast-paced atmosphere of a presidential campaign is actually, you know, in many ways, I would say faster than most Silicon Valley startup companies. You need to pivot on a dime according to the news of the day. You need to, you know, can entire technical projects just because of, you know, the direction that something is going, and be flexible in terms of, you know, what you're doing day to day. The schedules at a campaign are increasingly time consuming. So you might start off with a sane schedule a couple months away from an election, but as you get closer, turns into 12-hour days, 7-day weeks, that kind of world. And, you know, that's not terribly different than people who are passionate and working at a startup. So at least from an exhaustion perspective, I think there are a lot of similarities there. That focus on technology in a startup is helpful, I think. It's a shortcut to kind of making quick decisions with technology and understanding what investments will pay off and that kind of thing. From a security perspective, I think that you know, within companies, you generally have to work very hard to validate investment in security, and it's a persistent problem in our industry to describe why somebody should build a security team, or why they should pay for this product that you think will make things better, or why is it going to take 6 months to implement XYZ security program. And that that ability to communicate over to leadership why investment is worthwhile is incredibly important. At a campaign, generally you make that argument once or twice to leadership and say, like, hey, if this campaign has a major security event, people won't vote for us, because it's a pretty clear direct link there. And from then on, you have some amount of support, and ideally you have support to work in the way that you need to work to make things better. But it's not as continuous a case, I think, until you need time from other people. And then you always need to make that justification for trade-off between people's time and improving security and that kind of thing. I think those are skills and situations we run into no matter what industry you're in or what kind of company. Silicon Valley is interesting just because I think there's a much more willing appetite to invest in security in kind of the Bay Area, but more generically, like the technology focused world. And I think that appetite, you get much larger security investments in terms of people. You have larger teams with more specialization, more time on their hands, and you can do more interesting things with it. But I've always found it surprising what you can do with a small amount of people who are focused and talented and able to work within the problem set and system they have to have an impact. Not sure if that totally answers your question, but I think it's surprisingly similar, actually. But I would say the dollar figures are certainly different from an investment perspective. And often, the scope and kind of work you're doing is different just because kind of the threat model is different between a campaign and a business. But, as recent news has taught us, campaigns are becoming a much more interesting security world as well.
Yeah, and I think to that point, I mean, with the threat models being different, you also have what appears to be a pretty dramatically different, I wouldn't say employee base, but users, well, maybe their employees, the organization is so different. Did you run into challenges where, I mean, at a company, you have a little bit of power to say, this shall be the way. Did you run into challenges with the campaign being, well, there's volunteers and then there's a sort of transient access and pseudo employee relationship? Was that challenging?
Yeah, for sure. And just to give some maybe numbers to that perspective, I think when I joined the campaign, we had maybe 40 to 60 full-time employees. And that ramps up over about a year or just over a year, depending on the particular year. But that ramps up to around, 800, 900, 1,000, essentially full-time employees, and then a volunteer base that far outpaces that from a numbers perspective. And most of the people working there are not what you would call technology savvy. Like, they're there on a mission. They often have a specialty, around politics or elections, and aren't necessarily familiar with, best practices around security. So there's a bit of education there, but more importantly, I think it's setting people up for success and putting sane boundaries in place to just, not let things go off the rails in terms of, what people have access to, what kind of, freedom you give people to make decisions around security. You have to be a little more pragmatic around that approach than you would at a company who's kind of core business is security related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really gets back to that challenge of people. I can only imagine how difficult that must be to make everyone productive in all those environments, to meet them at their technical level and still have that secure by default appropriate level of control. You've seen security in different lights. You've been connected to the industry, obviously, for a number of years with B-Sides, with Pizza Hacker, with a variety of other channels and outreach. Sure. Do you think I mean, we're a bit of a dramatic bunch in security. Do you think there's an area where are we missing the mark? Where are we overhyping something, or maybe missing something and underinvesting in it? If you had, you know, kind of a magic wand, and you're going to make this world better in security, where would you point that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, one of the missions I've had in my career as I think I've gotten more experience and, been able to talk to more people is that I think there's an overinvestment, at least in the security culture and industry, in what I would call like the fetish of exploits, right? Like there's a lot of time and attention spent publicizing problems. And it's not to minimize the value there. Like obviously finding problems is like a key way to know how to make things better. But I think it gets an outsided amount of attention. And I think a lot of that is actually the fault of the security industry, right? When you go to DEF CON or other big conferences, the talks that attract the most people are going to be the ones that are like, I hacked an ATM, or I've got this new awesome exploit on iOS or something like that. And the talks and kind of content around defense is much less, I would say, sexy in a direct way, and gets, I think, less attention than it deserves. And I do truly feel that, you know, security holistically as a problem is one that we can only solve through community within the industry, and like talking about what's been working and innovations in making things better and how you approach problems is the only way for us to kind of stop the churn. The number of companies I've worked at that have like vulnerability management programs that don't work the way they should it's basically all of them, right? And we should be able to do better than that as an industry that's been trying to solve this problem now for 20, 30 years probably. We haven't made progress in a lot of fundamental problems from a defensive perspective. And I think a lot of that is kind of a resistance to talk about problems and solutions and to be more open with how you approach things. So I think those two work together, unfortunately, in a little bit of a stagnation pattern where, until we're willing to give the same time and attention to kind of protective concepts and best practices as we do to, hot new exploits, and until we're willing to be open and free to talk about that company to company or organization to organization, I think we're still kind of holding ourselves back a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've shared with teams of my own in the past, like, all right, it might be interesting for us to go, but are we going to learn anything if we know the latest way to hack a toaster? Like, how do I bring that into the company? There's certainly merits for continued academic research or even pushing the boundaries to disprove those horrible claims by vendors of this is hack proof and we don't need to think about it. But I'm totally with you. Like, I want defensive conferences. And man, I've said so many times, like, you know what's sexy for a CISO? Like the most boring things, like access control, like the fundamental problems, just doing those things at scale.
Sure.
Because it's so hard to operationalize.
Yeah, absolutely.
Patch management, inventory. Like,
yeah.
Super like boring,
basics,
but actually.
Of hygiene.
Yeah, you can't do anything without the basics underneath.
And I think the good news is I've been a huge fan of the B-Sides conference in San Francisco for the last couple of years. It's gotten much bigger and much better from like a content perspective. And same thing with, other kind of groups are trying to make this better, right? And I think, you and I were both involved in AppSec USA out of OWASP a couple of years back. You were a big part of the OWASP organization, which is focused on some of these challenges. Those kind of groups, I think, are a great way to, take some of the bigger baby steps we as an industry can take to focus on this kind of thing. But I don't think it will ever replace kind of the interpersonal communications and networks that we all build within the industry to, just one-on-one talk about problems and solutions and, unfortunately, there's a lot of kind of legal restrictions that are placed upon people. And I think the only way to be able to talk about things that, maybe your company isn't excited for you to talk about is to do it a little bit more interpersonally, right? To talk one-on-one with people that you trust, and that circle of trust becomes important. But hopefully we can widen that circle as we kind of grow the industry and as things get more complicated and more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And thanks for doing very much that right here with the large audience on the call and the interweb in general as we publish this.
Absolutely.
So shifting gears a little bit, the other fun thing about security is that what is true today will change next week, in 6 months, what we need to think about we hadn't thought about before. The architectures have changed so much. And I think we're living through this example of massive sudden shift to work from home. The notion of BYOD has probably been doubled down on even unexpectedly. We have outsourced personnel. And then to throw in yet another thing, the shift to cloud with infrastructure and SaaS. Yep. How do you reconcile all of these changes from a security strategy? How do you keep up without just running out with your hair on fire?
I mean, I think sometimes all of our hair catches on fire at some point, but
not mine.
You've got certain strategies to take care of that problem, I think. I think there's a couple, key things that I look for in terms of willingness from a company when I consider opportunities there. And, I think at a very core level, I'd like there to be an understanding that security is not the problem of the security team. It's a company-wide problem, and there's needs to be ownership and responsibility distributed across the organization to make that better. And I don't think that minimizes kind of the challenge or role of a security organization, but it shifts it subtly where I think security needs to become an enabler as opposed to a blocker whenever possible. And from like an intentional perspective, building out, the terms we use these days are like guardrails or paved roads, basically, to make security easy for people to do right. And that's really another thing that we've done really poorly over time is making security consumable by not only consumers, but I would say like employees at a company. And focusing on strategies that build out kind of foundational security controls that are easy for people to understand and consume, I think enables you to give them a little more trust and own a little more of their own world from a security perspective. And that lets your team have kind of a more distributed impact throughout the organization. And I think the same thing holds true for a lot of the challenges you mentioned, right? Bring your own device and outsourcing functions to other companies or other countries, that kind of thing. Both of those I would relate back to kind of the acceptance of risk. And if people are making poor decisions, they're generally not being held accountable for making a good decision around risk. And I think that also involves decisions around impact to the rest of the company. And one thing I try and help people understand at companies I work in is, certainly outsourcing something to another company or country makes financial sense and can help things move quickly. But we need to make sure that calculation is correct. And part of that calculation needs to be, what is the impact from a risk perspective? What is the impact from a time perspective on teams that need to support these kind of organizations and this kind of work? What is that cost truly? Because it's not the dollar figure you pay a company. It's actually also expense internally to support that kind of work and to accept that kind of risk. Same thing for bring your own device. And I think, thankfully, the technical solutions from phone providers specifically phone operating system creators, I think are becoming more flexible. I know both like Android and iOS now have some functionality to kind of partition things in the same way. But ultimately, you need to learn to trust your employees and in some way, shape, or form to have sensitive material on a personal device. And sure, you can have MDM or management or different controls on that to make it better, but ultimately it's still a risk calculation and you're intentionally like accepting some of that risk to let people use that device. Hopefully the technical solutions mature in a direction that makes that less of a concern for employees, because most employees are also concerned about their employer having access to their personal device. And likewise, it becomes an easier decision from a work perspective because you have sane partitioning where, if a phone becomes lost, you can, at least you can wipe the work side of that phone, or at least you have some sane ability to recover from a disastrous situation like that. Ultimately, I think these all relate back to kind of risk conversations and having some of those key foundations in place, going back to hygiene, like asset management, inventory, patch management, those kind of things only become more difficult in these worlds. And really investing to make that a slick story for your organization becomes a huge payoff, I think. And enables you as a security organization to do a lot of the things you want to do much, much easier and at a bigger scale.
Yeah, I mean, great thoughts all around. I think the accountability one is one that doesn't get enough discussion because you said it, you know, precisely, like security is not the problem of the security team. If the security team has to be accountable for all security breaches, then we have to have like God mode on all decisions, which is a ridiculous business model. Sure. Yeah, I've seen companies that struggle, like they let VPs make decisions to overrule security, but don't have any accountability if they go south. And yeah, that accountability model makes a huge difference to change the whole culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say, you know, I would credit my time at Netflix for a lot of my current perspective on security. And I think Netflix published a really famous culture presentation deck a bunch of years back before I joined even. And I remember reading that back when I was at Motorola, and I'm like, this is the kind of world I want to work in. And I think the way that culture actually influences accountability is very interesting, because the core tenet of the Netflix culture is freedom and responsibility, or it was. I haven't been there for a couple of years, so things might have changed. But what that means is, like, technically, they will let you do whatever you think is good. They're hiring you because they trust your judgment, but you as an individual are accountable for the decisions you make. And I think that reinforces a lot of people's desire to focus on security, because if you have poor judgment on something and it opens us up to, you know, a lot of risk or potentially a breach or something, they will hold you accountable for that. You're the one who made that choice. And that's a pretty, I think, direct line to accountability, but at any organization, I think we need to find those strings that help hold teams, organizations, and individuals accountable for kind of the choices they make. With that becomes, there's a responsibility to inform on what that is and what the trade-offs are. So I'm also a huge believer in kind of awareness and education. I think that is absolutely like a key piece of the puzzle in any organization, no matter the size, to help kind of make this reality of accountability real.
Definitely, good stuff. So looking back at the years you've had in security and the journey you've made, what would you recommend to someone who wants to enter the field? And I guess similarly, what about someone who's in the field that wants to strive into security leadership one day?
Yeah, ultimately, I think, and you know, it's probably the same advice you'd give anybody to go into any field, but it really does help to be like passionate about the stuff you're working on. Security is an unforgiving industry if you don't love what you're doing, or you don't find some gratification in terms of the constant change in state of the art, you know, the need to solve novel problems no matter where you go, and a willingness to try new things. It is not a place to go if you're only willing to you know, implement pattern A, B, and C, but definitely not D, E, or that one that you haven't invented yet. And I think that individual passion is kind of the key thing that unlocks both satisfaction with your industry, but also gives you the motivation to be ambitious and grow in your career. For me personally, you know, making the leap from individual contributor to manager was not an easy decision. I really enjoyed and still enjoy kind of the technical challenge of making things better and solving like interesting and new problems. I think going into management and leadership, you need to find that same kind of satisfaction from being able to have that impact with individuals within your team and organization, right? Helping impart, you know, hopefully good judgment and wisdom to them, and helping them understand that, you know, ultimately these are problems that, you know, there is no perfect solution for, and we just need to have, you know, good judgment in how to approach it, but also good technical skills to make that a reality. So I do think, you know, it's great to have a technical understanding of where things are and where things are going. Eventually, as you take a journey into kind of management and leadership, you need to step away from that from a hands-on perspective. And, you know, ideally you can like iterate that. My favorite line to people on my team at Netflix was, if you ever catch me like working on a technical problem that's in the critical path of what we're trying to do, please stop me from doing that and tell me to like shut my computer and give it to them. Because I'm happy to tinker and build things, but I just don't want to be blocking people because my time is better spent within the organization, building partnerships and relationships, and with my team, helping them, you know, giving them context on the problems we're solving and hopefully helping them advance their own career as well. But yeah, I think, you know, it starts with that passion in the industry. And ideally, that's something you can carry forward as your role shifts from individual contributor to manager to leader to owning an organization or something like that.
Yeah, that is a fantastic line, though. If you ever catch me on the critical path of the technical project, close the laptop. I love that. That's really good. We are coming up at the end of the half hour here. I promised a chance for some questions from the audience. We got more than we can accommodate, which is awesome. Thank you. We're going to cherry pick a couple, maybe just one even. This one's a doozy.
The best one.
A doozy. I've thrown out the Midwestern in me with a doozy. What techniques and investments did you make to address nation state actors and threats as opposed to the normal corporate controls you put in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes down to one, education and awareness, because, you know, still I'm a pretty strong believer that the easiest path into an organization by a dedicated attacker is going to be you know, the social aspect, right? So you can't really solve social engineering without awareness and education as part of the solution there. But more than that, I think that guardrail approach, that paved road approach, ideally means that the most important things you can invest the most time in. And you can protect either, you know, the data that's most important or the services that are most important, and have some faith that people are using, some faith that you can also check on, right? But some faith that people are using the best practices that your team has built out. Built out to help them solve security problems, to help them make good decisions. And ideally, it just becomes harder and harder to make a bad decision. Or the opportunity cost that a team incurs to make a bad decision becomes higher and higher because they would have to go off that road. They'd have to jump over a guardrail to make that work. And it's not necessarily a quick solution, but I do think it's one that really pans out as a company evolves and as kind of engineering challenges pile on top of each other. So having those guardrails that become, that don't necessarily confine people to do what they need to do, but increasingly, like there's no reason for people to avoid them either, right? Because the thing that they need to do is so easy to do from a secure perspective that they're happy to stay within those guardrails. And you can focus your time as a security team on the outliers, the people that truly can't exist within that world, or the people that have a truly novel problem. And I think from a nation state actor perspective, that really speaks to the ability to focus on like the truly challenging technical threats that we have. But I would again say that they all start with the fundamentals of like hygiene. Once you get those in a way that you can leverage methodically as you do other business, like ideally there's automation and APIs and data sets that are readily available to your security team to be able to understand like where are my risks, where are my outdated systems, who owns this system, can I go talk to them, what does a system do, that doesn't look normal, I should highlight that. The APT threats that people love to talk about only become economical when you have like high enough bars that people need to invest in something truly complex to get over them. And frankly, most organizations aren't there. Until we can actually solve some of these fundamental problems, I think that's your best investment. Making it iteratively harder day by day, ideally quarter by quarter, for these threats to actually be successful pays off, you know, maybe not as satisfyingly in the short term by sexy vendor product that might solve some small problem for you. But I think you are making a bigger impact in the long run.
The attack can be as advanced as they want, but if there's an easy path to take, they'll just take that in there. So totally agree. Yep. Very good. Well, we'll go ahead. Cool. We could talk all day, but we'll wrap it up here. Ben, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for everyone that joined us live and for everyone in the interwebs that are watching this recorded. I'm Michael Coates. This presentation was brought to you, sponsored by Altitude Networks. Think of us as a cloud-focused DLP, protecting data in platforms like G Suite, 365, Box, et cetera. It's the latest thing I'm working on. It's been very exciting, so feel free to reach out to us if that's a problem area for you. And as you're all part of the security community, thanks so much. It is a wild challenge. And as Ben mentioned so correctly, you know, we're only going to get there if we work together. So really appreciate, Ben, your time and everyone that joined us. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone.